From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, mythologist William Henry joins us, shapeshifters, and the Anunnaki. Get ready for that. Here's what's happening. Well, the Swiss postal system has stripped WikiLeaks of a key fundraising tool and accusing the founder of lying and immediately just shutting down one of his bank accounts. The swift action by the Post Finance financial arm of the Swiss Post came after it determined that the Australian citizen provided false information regarding his place of residence during the account opening process. He had told the Post Finance that he lived in Geneva, but could offer no proof that he was a Swiss resident, a requirement of opening such an account. WikiLeaks still under fire. Google is making the leap from digital librarian to merchant and a challenge to Amazon.com and its Kindle electronic reader. The long-awaited internet bookstore, which opened Monday in the U.S., draws upon a portion of the 15 million printed books that Google has scanned into its computers during the past 6 years. About 4,000 publishers, including CBS Corporation's Simon & Schuster, Random House, and Pearson's Penguin Group, are also allowing Google to carry many of the recently released books in a new store. Times are a-changing. Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez blamed criminal capitalism for global climate phenomena, including incessant rains that have brought chaos to Venezuela, killing 32 people and leaving 70,000 homeless. And several of the big mortgage players are playing Santa Claus this year, saying that they will not evict borrowers in default during the 2 weeks surrounding Christmas. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the two government-controlled mortgage giants, are freezing all foreclosure evictions on mortgage loans they own or back from December 20th through January 3rd. Catherine Austin Fitz is with us. And Catherine, of course, short-term, to be sure, what happens after January 3rd? They'll pick it up again, right?
They'll pick it up, George. If you look at the dates that they're postponing or they're freezing, it's December 20th to the 7th. It's the time when you can't get anything done anyway between the courts and the servicers and everything else. And so you might as well use that time to do your paperwork and go back to work on the 7th. So there are operational reasons to do this. The other thing, George, is we're talking about financial institutions whose brand is in the toilet. If you look at how they've run their operations, I mean, essentially in the mortgage area, I would say criminal enterprises. And it's really at the point where they're seeing so much anger and resistance that they really have to be careful.
Yeah, absolutely. And
this
what kind of
year? This is taxpayers' money. They're playing. These are government-funded, bailed-out organizations. So they're, you know, they're having nice Christmas bonuses at the taxpayers' expense while they're throwing the citizens out of their homes.
What are we going to do, Catherine? Mixed feelings. Number one, you got to pay your mortgage. You know, you can't keep your house for free. What do we do about all this?
Well, George, you know, there are many things we can do, but it's going to require place-based solutions. I told you the story of when I was assistant secretary, we had a town that had 70% of their mortgages in default and owned by Freddie, Fannie, and FHA. And I said to my staff, look, just have them create a trust. And we'll swap them the mortgages for equity because the place needs to reinvent itself. And it's the same here. The problem is that people have falling income and rising expenses. And unless you deal with that, and it's going to take a community or a county-based strategy to re-engineer those cash flows. And that comes back to, are we going to continue to use our government spending and contracts and investments to prop up, you know, fees for our friends, or are we going to use it to build a healthy economy?
Catherine, roll the dice. What's 2011 going to be like for folks?
2011 is going to, the slow burn is going to continue, George. We've got a lot of stuff to slug through. There's going to be a lot of meanness coming down from Washington and Wall Street at the same time. The day the American people decide, you know, we've had it with these guys and start to really shift things, just imagine if all the money shifted out of the big banks into community banks. And people started to barter and circulate more locally and stop trying to get along with the top, you know, with the powers that be. I think, you know, there's an incredible shift coming. You feel it. We all feel it. And You know, the day we all start talking, really starting acting locally and shifting our money, a lot can happen, George.
Absolutely. Catherine, thanks so much. Police in Pittsburgh mistook a blood-splattered horror movie set for a real-life murder scene for 8 hours. One officer labeled the room the most grisly murder scene he'd witnessed in his 35 years in law enforcement. Firefighters responding to a call at the George Washington Hotel happened upon the room. They saw blood splattered everywhere, bottles of alcohol scattered about the room, and a piece of scalp and hair still attached. 8 hours into their investigation, police realized the blood wasn't real and that they were dealing with a set left over from the new Terminal Hotel, a horror film starring the late Corey Haim, who died of an overdose at the age of 38. A U.S. Airways flight headed to Phoenix made an emergency landing in Pittsburgh after a dog on board bit a passenger and a flight attendant. The flight left Newark, New Jersey. A passenger carrying a dog let the animal out of its carrier, and that's when it went wild and bit the two. You know, there's a place for magic in science, right? 5 years ago, on a trip to Las Vegas, neuroscientist Stephen Macnick and Susanna Martinez-Conde realized that a partnership was in order with a profession that has an older and more intuitive understanding of how the human brain works. Magicians, it seems, have an advantage over neuroscientists. She and Macnick, her husband, use illusions as a tool to study how the brain works. Illusions are revealing because they separate perception from reality. Magicians take advantage of how our nervous systems, our eyes, sense of touch, minds, and so on, are wired to create seemingly impossible illusions. Their discoveries are detailed in their new book, Sleight of Hand, What the Neuroscience of Magic Reveals About Our Everyday Deceptions. In a moment, Stephen and Susanna join us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Let me introduce Stephen Macnick and Susanna Martinez-Conde as laboratory directors at the Barrow Neurological Institute. Now, that's in Phoenix, Arizona, where they study various aspects of visual, sensory, and cognitive neuroscience. They are also members of the Academy of Magical Arts, like the Magic Castle in Hollywood. I've been there. Magic Circle in the UK, the Society of American Magicians, and the International Brotherhood of Magicians. Here they are on Coast to Coast, Stephen, Susanna. Stephen, Susanna, how are both of you?
Hi, George. Thank you for having us.
Hi, Susanna. How are you? Good. Good to have both of you. Now, this is fascinating. About a month ago, I had the opportunity to see Criss Angel perform in Las Vegas. And, I mean, what an incredible illusionist. I mean, he had his partner, she got into a box. She disappeared right before our eyes. And then in 5 seconds, she's at the end of the theater, the back end of the theater. It must have taken 15 seconds to get back there. I don't know how they do this. What's going on here?
Well, we talk a little bit of in our book. It's actually called Sleights of Mind, not Sleight of Hand. It's sleights, plural, of mind. We talk about how magicians manipulate our attention and awareness by basically taking control and hacking our brains. And the way they do this is that our brains are already hardwired to use attention, the cognitive process, to enhance certain things in the world while suppressing others. And magicians have realized this far earlier than scientists ever did, and have used it so that they could manipulate what you're paying attention to and suppress everything else, like what they're doing with their other hand. And large stage illusions like the Criss Angel show are exactly the same thing, but on a grander scale.
Have all the great magicians, back to Harry Houdini and all of them, have they practiced this?
Yes, all magicians manipulate our perception and our cognition, fundamentally our attention, but also our memory. They even implant false memories so that when you try to reconstruct what happened on stage, you cannot put it together because it's like trying to put together a puzzle with the wrong pieces. They use the illusion of choice. They have spectators make decisions that they think are completely free, even though that's not the case. So they really manipulate all of our cognitive processes. Magic is more in the mind than in the eye.
Who taught them, Susanna? How did they learn how to manipulate our brains?
Well, magic has a very long tradition. It's a form of art that is several thousands of years old. So there's been a lot of accumulated knowledge in the field, and this has been transmitted sometimes from masters to apprentices, and of course there are a lot of treatises and books on magic, as well as instructional videos, and a lot of magicians are self-taught. Others take classes, so it really varies a little bit. There's not a single way to become a magician.
Stephen, have you performed magic yourself?
Yes, as part of our training to basically learn how magic manipulates the brain, we decided we needed to learn magic ourselves in order to design experiments in the laboratory to make use of these amazing techniques to increase the rate of discovery. After all, the whole point of this project was for us to poach what magicians know, bring it back to the lab, and use it to do better experiments than what scientists could do before. So in learning magic, to make sure that we really understood it, we actually took lessons for about a year from a magician here in Phoenix. And to make sure we knew well enough, we actually auditioned at the Magic Castle, and we're happy to enter that prestigious club as professional magicians.
Well, that, you know what, and it is a very prestigious club indeed. I know Brandon Scott very well, and he's one of the great magicians there. What is it about the brain that allows it to be tricked? I mean, we're looking at this event. We're looking at whatever illusion they're doing, and our eyes see it, yet all of a sudden, in the blink of an eye, they have performed this incredible trick. How do they do it so quickly?
On stage or on TV are deceptively simple. If you actually know the technique, the manipulation that is taking place, then you immediately wonder, well, how could I not see this? It should have been so obvious. And that is because our brain only really perceives a tiny amount of what's in front of us. And not only magic shows, but in everyday life, we often look, but we don't see, and we don't see because our attention is not engaged, or is engaged in the wrong thing, or it's split among different locations, and that's something that magicians know very well. And in fact, several magic tricks are designed so that attention is split in several places.
Stephen, I'm going to ask you to violate the magician's creed, and that is to try to tell us a trick. In the Criss Angel trick, for example, the woman gets in the box. Within seconds, they open the box. She's not in it anymore. She's at the end of the theater. I saw her get in the box, didn't I?
Well, I don't know exactly how they do that trick. That specific, there's multiple different methods to do that type of trick. But unfortunately, that particular type of trick is not very interesting, and if it's the method I think it is. It's not very interesting to how the brain works, and the reason for that is because it's a gimmick. So what a gimmick is it's a device or a tool that a magician will use to make it look like that magic is happening, for instance. They may have a gimmick to hide a card or to hide something else in plain sight just by tucking it away somewhere. So that kind of thing is actually, it doesn't rely on our brain processes. And it's not very interesting in terms of how the brain works. So it's not one of the things that we actually study. And these types of stage illusions, usually it's done with smoke and mirrors, to put it in simple terms.
And literally, right?
That's right, and actually literally. And so they're optical illusions. And so optical illusions are those that are done with smoke and mirrors so that the image that arrives at the eye is already illusory, whereas visual illusions are really interesting to neuroscientists because that's where the image arrives to the eye is physically one thing, but what you perceive is something else because of the way the brain processes information. And so visual and cognitive illusions are what we're really studying here as neuroscientists in magic, and we're not studying so much the gimmicks and the optical illusions.
What? I would add to that that even when a magician uses a gimmick or a mechanical contraption, it's still making use of the assumptions and expectations that the audience has, because it's almost always the case that the spectators are making some false assumptions about what's going on stage, and that would be for sure the case in stage tricks such as in the Criss Angel show.
That's right.
You know, and they're how important is, though, your book is called Sleights of Mind, how important is the sleight of hand in magic, Stephen?
Well, sleight of hand is essentially manipulating objects in your hands, for instance, coins or cards, in such a way that you're also manipulating where the mind is paying attention. Now, certainly there's some dexterity that's required to do certain types of tricks.
Sure.
But for the most part, you don't need to be that dexterous. You need to be practiced in terms of how you move so that you look like you're moving in a natural way when in fact you're doing something completely unnatural with your hands. But that kind of thing, people would be surprised at what the training is involved in sleight of hand, that it is 99% a manipulation of people's attention and 1% actual being dexterous and moving things around in a surprising way.
Is any of this magic? Is any of it real? Are they really doing some of these things? I mean, does Criss Angel levitate, Susan?
In none of our research, we have seen the magicians actually defeat the laws of nature. It all occurs within the physical constraints of reality, but they're very good at making it appear otherwise.
Why do we want to be tricked, Susanna? The people just want to be tricked.
That's actually an interesting part of watching a magician show. A good magician will generate trust, empathy in the audience so that spectators will want to play along, will want to be tricked, will want the magician to succeed rather than trying to figure out the trick at every point, and that, of course, wanting to believe, suspending the disbelief, is something that enhances the experience of magic. We don't know why this is the case, why people would want to suspend their disbelief, but some magicians have said that perhaps it's because we all want to experience this sense of wonder that we feel all the time when we're children, and as adults, we rarely feel only when we go to a magic show, for instance. So that may be part of the answer, but it's an interesting question and one that we're not close to answering scientifically.
Stephen, how far can the brain be pushed to be tricked?
Oh, the brain can really fool itself, and one of the things that you know, we, like other scientists here at the Barrow Neurological Institute, will be doing some experiments. Say we're studying some cognitive illusion, we'll break it down to its simplest components and test one of them at a time in front of say our subjects in order to isolate, you know, how that cognitive illusion works. And that's how scientists usually work. But magicians are exactly the opposite. They'll take all of the various possible components they can use and use them simultaneously in order to confuse the spectator as much as possible, so that even if their misdirection is not perfect, then their sleight of hand will be good enough to cover for that, and their sleight of hand will be so perfect that it'll cover for the misdirection in case that goes down. And that's one of the things we really learned from the magicians, is that in these cognitive illusions, in some ways, that you need to make things more complex, even for the science. And so for the case of the science, we could use multiple different complex illusions at once, but just change one of them at a time across conditions instead of just isolating one at a time.
Well,
so that's been a really interesting thing that we've learned from the magicians to do scientifically.
And I've noticed that with some of these stage magicians, music, other people running around on the stage while they're up there ready to do their tricks, a lot of that kind of confuses the brain a little bit, doesn't it?
Absolutely. That's what we're talking about when we say that they distribute your attention. They're splitting your attention across multiple different things. And, of course, you don't know what you need to be paying attention to in order to see the secret move. So they use this type of method all the time in order to keep you guessing.
All right. Stay with us. We're going to take phone calls with both of you. Susanna Martinez-Conde, Stephen Macnick with us. We're talking about their work, Sleights of Mind, what neuroscience of magic reveals about our everyday deceptions. We're going to talk magic when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, investigative mythologist William Henry joins us. We'll talk about some of his work. We're going to take your phone calls, though, when we come back. Neuroscientists revealing magician secrets, sort of, their work, sleights of mind, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Susanna Martinez-Conde with us and Stephen Macnick as we're talking about magicians. Stephen, how difficult is it for the brain to shut out other information in order to concentrate on another form? Is it hard?
Well, it's not that it's hard. It's that it's been hardwired to do this over, that we've evolved to do this. So magicians have kind of built this into how they actually design their tricks even before scientists, psychologists, or neuroscientists knew that this was what the brain was doing. They basically just figured it out by trial and error.
Susanna, can you give us any kind of illustration of a magician doing something or a test where the brain was tricked? Did you two experiment with anything?
Yes, we're doing a number of experiments in the laboratory. We're doing a collaboration with Matt King. He's a top magician. He's a headliner in Harrah's in Las Vegas in the Strip, and he does. He's probably the best magician in the world who does this kind of manipulation. He throws a coin from one hand to the other, only he doesn't really throw it. He retains it in the first hand and pretends to catch it in his second hand. Only you see the coin actually flying from the first hand to the second hand, even though it's never left the first hand.
How does that happen? How do you see it when it's not even there?
Well, we're still investigating it, but basically he has learned to mimic the motions that you produce when you throw the coin for real, that it becomes a sort of super stimulus to the brain, and that the motion processing mechanisms that we have get stimulated by this pretend motion, sort of like when you pretend to throw a stick to a dog for a game of fetch, and the dog goes after it, only to realize there's no stick having been thrown. So it's a little bit with our motion-sensitive neurons as well.
That is amazing. Okay, so what happens, Stephen and Susanna, if public officials learn these magician techniques to try to trick our brains with things?
Oh, they have learned them already.
So this is what rhetoric
is.
So if you think about what when politicians use their trade, they're using rhetoric, which is nothing else but the manipulation of your emotions and what you're attending to and what you're thinking about with words. And so it's very similar to mentalism, which is a type of magic that is the same thing as misdirection with coins or cards, but it's just using information instead of an object. And the politicians have learned the same kinds of things through rhetoric.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, they have learned the techniques of magicians, or maybe magicians have learned from them. Who knows, huh?
Well, we all use these techniques to some extent, but the real professionals, the magicians, and perhaps politicians in some cases, are the real masters of misdirection.
All right, let's take some calls. Bartlesville, Oklahoma. Rob, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Rob.
Hi, George. Thank you so much. I must first say I am actually I'm trying to find the word surprised at the two magicians you were talking to, because they gave you the most wonderfully illustrative, yet elusive answer I've ever heard as to your question, how do they transport from one side to the other? All right. And we cannot really reveal
how particular tricks or magicians are done on stage. In fact, that would go against the guidelines of the magical societies to which we belong.
We do reveal some tricks in a careful way in our book, and the ethical guidelines of the associations are that we no magician can reveal tricks to people who don't want to know it. And this is a case where there might be someone listening who didn't want to know how that trick worked.
I understand. Am I allowed to ask the question to George personally? Am I allowed to reveal the answer if you give the audience enough time to turn off their audio listening device?
No, I want you to tell me. I'm not going to have them turn down the radios. Go ahead.
Okay. This is so classic. This dates back to hundreds of years. There's a great movie called The Prestige, and it's got a great twist at the end. However, are you ready? This is the kick. I will do it. And I feel horrible. I really do. But here it goes. There are twins involved, and the gimmick you refer to is a trap door that a very slight human body can fit into in a very small amount of time. And then, presto, they're gone. Well, on the other side, dressed in the same attire,
uh-huh,
and ready for the performance is the twin. I'm so sorry. I'll let you go.
No, that's okay. I mean, I've always suspected that. I think was it in your research or somebody else's, Stephen and Susanna, that you were talking to a professor in a video clip, and he was talking to somebody, and then people walked behind him holding a door. And I guess he concentrated on that. They switched the person who was in front of him, and he didn't even know that?
That is actually Dan Simon's research. He has shown that in a number of situations, people can switch, and whoever they're talking to, they don't notice the difference. And it is true that in some magicians throughout history have used twins to accomplish a variety of tricks. But the fact is that twins are, in most cases, not really necessary, because our brain will just assume that two individuals that may not even look very much alike are the same person if the circumstances are appropriate.
That is something else. Let's go to Kat in St. Louis. Hey, Kat, welcome to the show.
Yes, and once I say this and you understand what the comment and the question is, I'll go ahead so I keep this brief and let another person on get off the air. But there had been in the last year or two in a couple of technical magazines articles about dealing with Alzheimer's, and I'm wondering if they can comment on this once I state what they're doing, and it has made its way to a common daily health magazine. People are trying it, and with some Alzheimer's patients, it's working. It's like a visual illusion. They see what they see there. They don't see their son or daughter. It is their son or daughter, but they don't see that it's them. What these doctors and neurologists are having people do is writing down and having a nurse or someone hand a note, and they read the note, and it says, this is your father, this is your husband, this is your sister, your brother, your daughter. The patients then become calm, read the note, and for the rest of the day, they look at the note on and off, and they remember.
Jeez.
They remember who the person is. Now, do you understand, and can I go ahead and hang up so that they can comment?
Absolutely. Let's give it a try.
Okay.
Who, you want to try that, Stephen?
We're not aware of that particular therapy that's being done, but we have speculated in our book that one of the things that magicians can really potentially help us with is with understanding memory and using memory techniques. One of the things that magicians can do in order to create the feeling of magic is they can memorize, using special techniques, vast amounts of data very quickly. And so that can make it seem like they're doing magic because, for instance, let's say they memorize all the information for dozens of people in one of their shows. They know that this particular show is going to have those people because, say, it's a corporate event, so they know who's basically coming. And then they can look up on the Internet various people from that group and memorize huge amounts of data. And because they can regurgitate it in their show to these people, it seems like they're reading their mind or doing magic when, in fact, it's just a memorization technique. And what's interesting here is that if we could use these same memorization techniques to help Alzheimer's patients, say, just remember what order to put their clothes on in the morning, maybe we could help them stay home longer before being institutionalized, maybe stay home one more year. And that would be a major advance in that field. So that's the kind of things that we've been talking about in terms of using magical techniques to help patients with cognitive decline, such as Alzheimer's patients.
Has technology changed over the years where magicians of 50 years ago weren't better than the magicians of today? Or are the illusions still there?
The fundamental mechanisms by which the illusions work in the brain are the same. They have remained the same since the beginning of magic. But the technology of magic has evolved. It used to be, in fact, that magicians were at the forefront of technology, and that, for instance, Robert Houdin, which is the magician from which Houdini took his name as a tribute, he used to use electromagnetism in his show when very few people were familiar with it, and that he could make objects appear light or heavy just basically using magnets, and that this was technology that was not available to the masses. Today, it is not true anymore for the most part that magicians are the forefront of technology. In fact, a lot of the techniques that we see in magic shows are techniques that magicians have been using for the last several decades. But there are a few exceptions, magicians, for instance, Jason Latimer, who won the Magic Olympics a couple of years back, that uses a number of optical techniques involving lasers and that advanced technology that it is not known by the public at large.
First time caller, Adam in San Diego, and you're up with us. Hi, Adam, go ahead.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I just wanted to know if you guys have done anything on a mass level where you're sitting, in religion or any other area where, we're being manipulated. If you guys reveal any of that, in your book at all.
Well, yes, absolutely. So there are many of the major skeptics of the U.S. and of the world in general happen to be magicians. And the reason for that is because many of the charlatans and frauds of the earth or religious figures who do things like faith healing are also magicians, and you're doing the same exact tricks that magicians do. So some of the magicians who are more ethical and don't feel like they should be stealing people's money and claiming that they're healing them, these magicians will call them out and show how they can do the same exact thing, but show exactly what those methods are. For instance, James Randi is famous for the James Randi Educational Foundation, mm-hmm. and they have a $1 million challenge where they have challenged any person to do something paranormal under standard laboratory conditions or under control conditions. And so far, nobody's been able to win that money because of that skeptic group. And so it's very common that magicians are the ones who show how these religious leaders are actually just doing magic tricks on us all.
Stephen, have the magicians learned neuroscience or how did they tap into this knowledge?
The information is starting to flow both directions. So, for example, Penn and Teller have some new parts of their act that come directly from science, doing these types of change blindness and inattentional blindness routines that we talked about just a minute ago with Dan Simons. So there is influence in magic from the science end. And we are now doing experiments to find out how to manipulate the brain using magic, and it's inevitable that we'll find out certain things about the magic tricks themselves that will improve the magic tricks. Like, for instance, there may be the dogma in magic that a certain magic trick works because you're manipulating attention and you're not manipulating emotions, and so you should concentrate on the attention. But in fact, it may be that emotions are more important than attention, and you can only parse these things out under controlled experiments that are systematic and scientific. And so that's the kind of thing that will be contributing to magic.
How good are they at knowing the manipulation of the mind, like the Copperfields and the Chris Angels, the Doug Hennings of past? How good were they in knowing the science behind this?
Well, they're really good. I mean, they're really the masters at doing what they do, manipulating the awareness and the attention of the spectators. But the underlying science, it really depends on the particular magician. You don't need to know a lot of neuroscience to be an exceptional performer. But the magicians that we initially started our collaboration with, Teller from Penn and Teller, James the Amazing Randy, Matt King, Apollo Robbins, and Johnny Thompson, the great Thompsoni, these were five very special magicians, in that they were all very interested in not only performing magic, but understanding the principles that make the magic work in the mind of the spectator.
Charles in Chico, California, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Charles. We'll get you in here.
Hi. Thank you, first-time caller. I listen to you as often as I can.
I've
got a simple barroom mind trick. I'll ask you to clear your mind, and maybe your guests can explain how this mentally works with people. Just give me your immediate answer, if you would. Simple thing. Spell silk for me.
Silk? S-I-L-K.
What do cows drink?
Milk.
Water.
Oh, you got me. Very good.
One more if you can keep your mind.
Oh, no, you're going to embarrass me before millions. All right, one more.
How many years have you been driving
a car? Since I was 16, I would say 44 years.
All right, spell spot.
S-P-O-T.
What do you do when you come to a green light?
S-T-O-P. Oh, yeah, green light. You did it to me again. I'm milquetoast in his hands. I'm putty.
You know, maybe your guest could explain. I'll go off the air and listen, and maybe your guest could explain how this works in the mind.
All right. And we didn't rehearse this, did we, Charles?
No, we did not.
All right. Good. Thanks. All right. So what happened to me?
Well, I think this is two very nice examples, one of which we also describe in our book. The Stroop effect, which is an effect in which you tend to continue along the same pattern of behavior once you've set it in motion. And
it's actually called priming.
And he primed me, no doubt about that. Hook, line, and sinker. It is amazing how that works. I mean, and you don't realize you're doing it, do you?
No, not at all. So, for instance, there are examples where you can be shown a series of colors in a row, and then but the colors are actually in the form of words with other colors. So you might see a blue, yellow, and a green, red, and a orange, blue. So you'll read the words but have the opposite color, and then they'll ask you to say what this other color is, and you'll of course be confused because of the priming involved in the Stroop effect. So this is a really unknown. We don't know how this works in the brain, but we do know that it has to do with priming, which is a synaptic plasticity effect in neurons.
Well, good job, both of you. The book is called Sleights of Mind, What Neuroscience of Magic Reveals About Our Everyday Deceptions. Their website is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. It is sleightsofmind.com. Fascinating. And I got to tell you, I was tricked hook, line, and sinker, to be sure. Up next, investigative mythologist William Henry joins us on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about the Anunnaki and shape-shifting reptilians on Coast to Coast AM.